Comrade Chairman, comrades. First, an explanation and an apology. When I was first approached with the proposal that I give a series of lectures on the international, I thought that the subject could be encompassed within a series of three lectures. I found, however, that I had bitten off a bit more than I could masticate in three lectures. And now I hope to be able to do it in six, but three will have to be postponed to a later date. So we'll go as far as we can in these three and then take up the other development sometime later. Now, we attach great importance to studying the lessons of the past, both the victories and defeats of the working class movement on a world scale. In this, we differ with the spokesmen and pundits of the New Left, whose tendency is to deny that we have any lessons to learn from the past, and who reject past experience as, if you'll excuse the expression, borrowed from the New Left, irrelevant. I guess it's inevitable in a movement of this kind, which is a very primitive one, very confused and groping, and one that takes place in a period where the working class itself is relatively quiescent, apathetic. The New Left really begins to date history some 10 years ago with the in the aftermath of the Khrushchev 20th Congress de-Stalinization speech. It was this process of de-Stalinization, together with the revolution in Hungary and the Poznan uprising, that led a whole section of the intellectuals, primarily in the Communist Party in Britain, to break with the CP and to begin the search for something new to replace what they have considered Marxism, the kind of Marxism they learned in the Stalinist movement. If you recall, the movement began with the publication of a magazine called the New Left Review in Britain, to be up together with a magazine called Universities and something else, I can't recall the title offhand. And from Britain, it came over to this country primarily through the writings of C. Wright Mills. C. Wright Mills cooperated and collaborated with the New Lefters in Britain, and then later became one of the main ideologues of the same tendency that developed here. And that's characteristic of the so-called New Left, is to tend to identify what they call the old left with the Communist Party. Many times you don't know what they're talking about. They sort of lump everything together and throw it all into one pot, designated all as the New Left. But in the main, it really was a rejection of Stalinism and the Stalinist version of Marxism. After the very bad experiences that they went through in that movement. In this country, probably one of the foremost ideological currents of the New Left are organized around studies on the left. And there, if you've been following that magazine and their views, they've been grappling with problems that they consider to be very new. And of course, they're not new at all. Most of them are as hoary as Methuselah. One of the problems is the question of the agency of social change. What is going to be the agency of social change in this country and in the other advanced capitalist countries? They reject the working class as the primary agency of social change, and so they cast about to find some substitute, some new elite, some social formation that will take the place of the working class. On the question of the party, they reject Leninism, that is the concept of the Combat Party, and democratic centralism. And they yearn for a return to the good old days of the Deb Socialist Party. Never having been in the party, they can, of course, speak freely about what, and very learnedly, about what the Deb Socialist Party was and is. They projected the idea of establishing what they call a revolutionary center. I know that was one of the debates carried on in their magazine. And the revolutionary center, presumably, would be that medium through which the new lefters would gradually coalesce and would lead to the formation of some kind of a political party. I remember an article by Stanley Aronowitz, one of the editors of the New Left, who discovered the virtues of the concept of the all-inclusive party, which again is nothing very new. We went through that experience 30 years ago with the Socialist Party when we entered the Socialist Party. At that time, on the basis of this concept of the all-inclusive party. Now, I happen to be acquainted with the old Socialist Party of the Debs days, which was not a Debs party by any manner of means, although Debs was the most prominent spokesman of it. And of the all-inclusive party also. And, if you want a very lively discussion circle, that would be a good direction to look. Providing you weren't serious about your ideas, and providing your perspective was not that of making a social revolution. In the so-called Deb Socialist Party, it reminds me of nothing more than the very divergent, heterogeneous, hostile and antagonistic currents which are present today in the New Left. At that time, they were all in the Socialist Party. Every rebel, everyone who rebelled against capitalism, found a place in the Socialist Party. And that included Christian socialists, pacifists, free love cultists, vegetarians, professional Christ killers, atheists, reformists of every variety, along with left-wing socialists, revolutionary socialists, constituted the left wing. The party was then very democratic, especially very tolerant of extreme right-wing views, not so democratic with the left-wing, however. They had what they called state autonomy. Each state was autonomous. Newspapers were not published by the Socialist Party, were not under the control of the party leadership or the party membership. Usually they were privately published and privately owned. Even the biggest mass circulation of papers. And at the very first crisis, that is the war, and even more so, with the October Revolution, why the organization just split wide open, not only in one part, but in a dozen different parts. And to yearn for a return to those days is like trying to, some people that yearn for a return to the good old days of the town hall meeting, where everything was resolved by an assembly of citizens getting together and engaging in participatory democracy, which may have been very good form that developed after the Revolutionary War, but it's a little dated. Many things have happened. And so you find a impatience on their part, especially with the Trotskyists who insist upon studying history and Marxism and trying to derive from such a study lessons which are applicable today. Not just an abstract study. To learn from the defeats and victories and to apply those lessons in the current struggle. The Revolutionary Party, our party, and our international, is, in this sense, the memory of the working class. And the parties of reformism, you can say, and of Stalinist revisionism are notoriously the parties of poor memory. Not only would they like to forget, they would like everybody else to forget their history, their development, and the source of their current policy, which is rooted in the past. And while it takes different forms, there's no essential difference today over the general thrust of their policy than what was true some years ago, a policy that led to a whole series of defeats. Now, I understand along with this lecture, Comrade Novak is going to lecture on the First and Second International. I don't know whether he's coming here, but he'll probably get the tapes. And there will probably be a more extensive series on the Third International and then on the Fourth International, where I hope to take up where this series leaves off. Now, for the first 10 years of the Trotskyist existence, that is from 1923 to 1933, the Trotskyist left opposition functioned as a faction of the Communist International. The struggle broke out in the Soviet Union, over the whole question of perspective of the revolutionary development, both in the Soviet Union and on a world scale. The left opposition, that is the Moscow opposition, led by Trotsky, then later merged with what was known as the Leningrad opposition, led by Zinoviev and Kamenev, to found the united left opposition,
which published its program. And the program was published in English in a translation by Max Eastman in a volume called The Real Situation in Russia. That was the program of the United Left Opposition. For with the victory of Hitler in Germany, Trotsky concluded that the Third International, as a common term, was dead. It was no longer a viable instrument for revolutionary change, and called for the formation of the Fourth International. Just as Lenin did in 1914, when the Second International, corroded by opportunism, joined, the various sections joined with their own bourgeoisie in supporting the war, Lenin said that the Second International was dead as a viable instrument of revolutionary change and called for the formation of a Third International. That was as long ago as 1914, 1915, early part of 1915. It then took some 5 years, from 1933 to 1938, before the actual founding Congress of the Fourth International was held, which adopted the transitional program. Now, from the very beginning, from the time that the Americans made contact with Trotsky's ideas in 1928, the American Party played a leading and, it would be true to say, a decisive role in the development and extension of the International Communist League, which was the Trotskyist world tendency, and established the Communist League of America in this country as the Trotskyist tendency of the Americans. You're all acquainted how this occurred, that at the Sixth World Congress, comrades Cannon and his Canadian comrade, what is his name? Spector, got hold of Trotsky's criticism of the draft program, were able to smuggle it out of Russia, and on that basis began a struggle inside of the Canadian party and in the American party for the ideas expressed in this platform. Asking only for the right to hold such a discussion at periods set aside by the party for this purpose, in pre-convention periods, but were summarily expelled. And it's true to say that from that day forward, the American Party has been one of the mainstays of the Fourth International, despite the fact that in 1940 we had to formally disaffiliate because of the Reactionary Voorhees Act, which made affiliation with an international organization a crime. Nevertheless, although formally severing our organizational affiliation, we played a very active role in the ideological struggles, in the leadership, in the organizational support, and in the help and participation of the Americans in all of the development of the Fourth International. Now, there is none, you see, up to the time of the First World War, the Fourth International didn't have much of an actual history as an organization. It was founded in 1938, 1939, war broke out. and the comrades in Europe. Some of them were lucky enough to get out. Some of them were thrown into Hitler's concentration camps. Some into Stalin's. Some assassinated, murdered, and let's say a few who were able to escape to exile. So for the whole period of the war, the actual material apparatus of the Fourth International existed here in this country. The Americans took primary responsibility for keeping the International alive in that very difficult period. And then it was after the end of the war in 1945, it was reestablished in Europe again in 1946. And that's really when the development of the Fourth International as an organization begins. The great contribution of the founding Congress was the adoption of the program called the Transition Program, the Death Agony of Capitalism, and the Tasks of the Fourth International. As I stated before, the origin of the left opposition in the Soviet Union stemmed from the differences that developed over the whole question of strategy, tactics, and program for the world revolution and for the development inside the Soviet Union. The Bolshevik Party in its entire leadership, and this there was no exceptions, at the time of the October Revolution considered that the revolution in Russia was the beginning, not the end, the beginning of the world revolution. From the very moment of its success, the establishment of the Soviet power, the leaders looked to the West, to one of the advanced capitalist countries of Europe to come to the assistance of the more backward country of Russia, which was one of the most backward countries in Europe. When the revolutions failed to materialize, that is, the successful carrying through of the revolutions, there were no lack of revolutionary developments. What there was a decided lack of revolutionary victories outside of the Soviet Union. The revolutionary wave receded after 1918, 1919, 1920. And they were defeated primarily because in no country in Europe did the left wing of the Second International, and all the socialist tendencies were affiliated with the Second International, including the Bolsheviks, did they succeed in building the kind of a party which was necessary to lead a successful revolution. This was Lenin's unique contribution. The concept of the combat party, of these strongly disciplined party, and the concept of the necessity of party leadership, both of the party leading the class leading the mass, and of leadership within the party, that constitutes his, they say, his unique and one of his greatest contributions to the art of revolutionary struggle. Trotsky became a Leninist on this question. He wasn't always a supporter of Lenin's views on the party. In fact, they were in opposing factions for a great part of their adult political lives. And it was only at the time of the revolution in 1917 that Trotsky acknowledged Lenin's priority on this question and accepted his leadership and became, as he called it, one of Lenin's pupils, just as Cannon in turn became a pupil of Trotsky on this and on the political questions. And we are all pupils of Cannon, Trotsky, and Lenin. The defeats in Europe due to the lack of a Bolshevik party inevitably led to a spread of ultra-leftism, adventurism, putschism, attempts to substitute the party for the class, and those of you who have read Lenin's Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder will remember how he polemicized against the ultra-leftism of these young formations. Without exception, the communist parties in Europe developed out of splits in the social democracy, in social democratic parties. Now, it's true that Lenin's party also was a faction of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, but it was more than that. From 1903, actually, this faction, the faction of the Bolsheviks, existed and functioned like a party. They were a party, although, as I say, considered themselves part of the international movement. This experience was not duplicated anywhere else. In the most promising section, the German section, the outstanding leaders of the left wing, Luxemburg and Liebknecht, rejected Lenin's concept of party building. And as a result, the creation of the party was so long delayed and came so late that the revolution was turned back and defeated, and Luxemburg and Liebknecht were assassinated. The first Congress of the Communist International in 1919 actually was attended by very few representatives, authentic representatives of organizations in Europe. Remember, 1919, Russia was then under blockade. The armies of imperialism had troops on Russian soil. Civil war raged on 21 fronts. It was very difficult for representatives to get into Russia, especially those applying for visas to attend the founding Congress of the Third International. But the Bolsheviks felt it was absolutely essential that they proceed with the proclamation, not only a proclamation of the necessity, but the actual organization of the Third International, because, for one thing, the representatives of the Second, the Yellow International, immediately following the war, attempted to reconstitute the Second International on the basis of the call for unity of the social democracy. And in order to head off this development and to indicate that that unity was of the type practiced by the right-wing social democrats, was unity with the capitalist class against the workers, the First International was proclaimed, the Third International was proclaimed, the organization meeting was set, The organization meeting resulted in the formation of the International and the adoption of a statement of principles. I have a picture on the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Third International, the Communist International, that was the magazine of the Comintern, published what do they call 10th anniversary? Centennial? No, what is the 10th? Huh? Well, whatever it is. A special edition. And in it they have photographs of the meeting of the First International, of the First Congress, of the Second Congress, and of the Third Congress. Well, the picture of the First Congress of the Third International, the hall was maybe half the size of this hall, and the congregation was less than what we have here in this room today. These were the pioneers who set out at that time to establish a Third International to overthrow world capitalism. That was their object and that was their aim. In 1920, Lenin wrote Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder against these ultra-leftist and putschist and adventurous tendencies. And the Second World Congress in 1920 had for its purpose a clear demarcation and differentiation in the world socialist movement. It was at this Congress, the second, that they laid down the 21 conditions for affiliation. The object of the 21 conditions for affiliation was to separate the parties of the Third International from any organizational connection with those elements that still clung to the Second International or centrist elements that oscillated between the Second and the Third International. They set down such conditions as to make it impossible for the opportunists who remained within the parties of the Second International to affiliate to the Third International. You had the big Italian party, for example, the Turati wing, which is the extreme right wing, coexisted with the left wing in one party. Turati carrying on his opportunist line, an extension of the kind of a line that he developed, carried through during the war, and the left wing that opposed the war and supported the Bolsheviks. Lenin had to not only point out this was an error, that you could never build a homogeneous combat party designed for the specific purpose of leading a struggle for the conquest of power on the part of that kind of a heterogeneous and antagonistic composition, and the 21 points were intended to end this sort of ambiguity which existed in parties requesting affiliation to the Third International. You remember that during this time there was a great revolutionary upsurge throughout the whole of Europe. The Norwegian Labour Party as a whole applied for affiliation to the Third International. The whole Italian party applied for affiliation. Parties and leaders who had become discredited during the war sought the cover of the Third International in order to re-establish their own prestige with the revolutionary mood and movement of the workers in this country. And Lenin was astute enough and shrewd enough to see what they were after and submitted these 21 conditions. So you agree with these conditions or you cannot affiliate with the International. And this split the movement wide open throughout the entire world. The Social Democratic Party split into the Communist parties and the Socialist parties. And a split that took the form of an attempt on the part of the centrists to establish what they call the 2.5 International, in between the Third International and the Second International. The Third International was red. That was the Red International. The Second International was designated as the Yellow International. They had betrayed the workers in the Second, in the First World War. And the 2.5 international, I suppose you could designate as the pinks, in between the reds and the yellows. They didn't last very long. The centrist formation that soon disappeared from the scene, but under the pressure of the left-wing movement of the masses, took a half step towards the Third International. Now, with the receding of the revolutionary wave and the realistic appraisal of the development in Europe, in which the communist parties were, in most cases, a minority of the working class parties, Lenin and Trotsky united in the Third World Congress in a struggle against the lefts. And they did it ostentatiously by proclaiming themselves as adherents of the right wing. They both said, "We are right wing," on this question of the necessity of conquering the masses before engaging in the conquest of power. You have to have the leadership, you have to attain the leadership of the majority of the working class, which in turn will draw the, at least a significant section of the petty bourgeois peasants behind them, before you can engage realistically in the struggle for power. And that the task of the communist parties then was to win the masses before engaging in the direct struggle for workers' power. There was a left wing at that time, representatives of the various parties, and in the Soviet Union, consisting of Bukharin and Radek, who led the left wing. They fought it out, and Lenin and Trotsky emerged victorious. By the way, the original proclamation for the first Congress, calling for the first Congress of the Third International, were signed by Lenin and Trotsky, who were the most authoritative and best-known spokesman of the Bolshevik Party. The Third World Congress in 1921 elaborated the tactic of the United Front. The tactic of the United Front was designed specifically to cope with this problem of working class divided between the Social Democrats on the one hand, Communist Party on the other, centrists in between. In order to unite the workers, first, in action for defense of their immediate interest, and second, that in the process of the struggle itself, to enable the workers through action to confirm what the Bolsheviks had been saying and continue to say about the betrayals of their leadership. Pointed out, it wasn't enough just to publish articles in magazines, newspapers, and books. The workers don't learn primarily from reading. They learn primarily through action, through their own experience, in struggle. And it was this particular problem that the tactic of the United Front was devised to solve. After the Third World Congress, Lenin was taken ill, and from that time we can date the beginning of the development of the bureaucratic caste in the Soviet Union on the basis of the defeats in Europe, on the tiredness of the mass that had gone through several years of civil war, the destruction of the economy, loss of faith or hope, at least in the immediacy of an extension of the revolution to the advanced countries which would come to the aid of the Soviet Union, there developed a struggle over the division of the products of Soviet industry and agriculture and the establishment of the bureaucracy. It was on this basis, and especially after the German defeat of 1923, that the bureaucratization became accelerated, and out of this development arose for the first time the promulgation of the theory of building socialism in a single country. Now, the German defeat of 1923 was the direct responsibility of the Communist International, which had intervened. It was then under the leadership of Zinoviev, who together with Kamenev established, Kamenev and Stalin established what was called the Troika, the triumvirate led the Russian party for this whole period. Zinoviev and Stalin advised the German party against undertaking a struggle for power when conditions had matured. Remember, this is the period when the French occupied the Ruhr, when there was a tremendous social crisis, when workers were abandoning the social democracy and coming over to the Communist Party, when it looked as though, and everybody was convinced, that the Communist Party really had a majority of the working class supporting it. They hesitated, withdrew, under pressure of the Communist International, became overly cautious, and missed the opportunity to lead a successful overturn in Germany. This further confirmed the prognosis of the Stalin faction and the triumvirate, that the revolution was not in the cards in Europe, and strengthened the more conservative tendencies within the Soviet Union. Now, in the ideological sphere, the attack of the triumvirate against Trotsky took the form of an attack upon the theory of permanent revolution. Seems rather odd, but they published a pamphlet which was translated in English called Leninism or Trotskyism by G. Zinoviev, I. Stalin, L. Kamenev. This was published about 1924, I think, 25, in this country. It has an article by each one in which the theory of the permanent revolution becomes the center and focus of their attack on what they designated as Trotskyism. Now, it's true that this material was circulated, but not Trotsky's views. The bureaucratization in the Comintern had reached the point where the views of the official spokesman for the ruling group were circulated, not only circulated, but parties and the leadership of parties were lined up on threat of being expelled unless they supported the majority faction. But nothing of Trotsky's views was permitted to circulate throughout the various sections of the Comintern. It's something similar to what is taking place today in China, for example. And this is nothing new. What's taking place in China today is a repetition of the so-called Hundred Flowers campaign, which was followed by the big campaign against the rightists. That is, you never hear the views of the opposition. You never hear stated what it is they stood for. What was their program? What were their views? What were their policies that warrant their stigmatization as, what, how do they stigmatize them now, as monsters, as ogres, and so forth and so on. That's all you get, is the official version. You don't even get a version of what their views are. All you get is they're stigmatized as counter-revolutionary, as seeking the restoration of capitalism, and so forth and so forth and so on, without any idea of what they stand for. The same sort of thing took place at that time. That is a worldwide campaign against Trotskyism and the theory of the permanent revolution, without Trotsky even being permitted, or the left opposition being permitted to have its views circulated in the sections affiliated to the Communist International.